You're listening to the Radiator 105.9 FM WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear two interviews with authors published by the Other Press. The first is a conversation with the author Denisha Smith, author of four novels, including The Illusionist, which was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. Her stories have appeared in numerous publications, and she has won a number of awards for her writing, including fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Ingram Merrill Foundation. Until recently, Smith was a cultural correspondent for the New York Times, specializing in literature and the arts. She has taught at Columbia University, New York University, the Breadloaf Writers Conference, and elsewhere. She lives in New York. Her new novel, The Honeymoon, was published by the Other Press earlier this month. Based on the life of George Eliot, famed author of Middlemarch, this captivating account of Eliot's passions and tribulations explores the nature of love in its many guises. The novel recounts George Eliot's honeymoon in Venice in June 1880, following her marriage to a handsome young man 20 years her junior. When she agreed to marry John Walter Cross, Eliot was recovering from the death of George Henry Lewis, her beloved companion of 26 years. Eliot was bereft, left at the age of 60 to contemplate profound questions about her physical decline, her fading appeal, and the prospect of loneliness. In her youth, Mary Ann Evans, who would later be known as George Eliot, was a country girl considered too plain to marry, so she educated herself in order to secure a livelihood. In an era when female novelists were objects of wonder, she became the most famous writer of her day with a male nom de plume. The Honeymoon explores different kinds of love and the possibilities of redemption and happiness, even in an imperfect union. Smith integrates historical truth with her own rich rendition of Eliot's inner voice, crafting a page-turner that is as intelligent as it is gripping. When I spoke with Denisha Smith, I began by asking about her interest in George Eliot. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
George Eliot, or Marion Evans, has been a lifelong interest to me, partly because she was one of the first great women novelists, and I am a woman novelist, a female novelist, and I looked at her partly as a role model, partly as someone whose beautiful writing I would aspire towards. I wondered what her life was like, what I could learn from her life. She was very important in the development of the English novel because she was an early writer to take us inside her characters' heads with a kind of depth that few writers before her had done. For example, Dickens was a writer who he defines his characters a lot by the way they talk, what they wear. He doesn't spend an enormous amount of time in analyzing their inner lives the way Eliot does in Middlemarch, for example. So that was her interest for me, mostly that she is the iconic woman author.
And then the other part of this question, I'm just fascinated by this part of her life being what you chose as a jumping off point to our getting to know her better. This part of her life, at the end of her life, she's married a much younger man because her longtime lover and basically husband, in her mind, he was her husband, George Lewis, has died. And she marries Johnny. So I wonder what drew you to this part of her life?
Well, I think that actually, on a personal level, I was drawn to it because I knew that she had married this much younger man when she was she wasn't in good health at the age of 60. She marries this guy. She's lost the love of her life. She tries to reclaim her life, and yet it seemed to end in tragedy. First, he tried to kill himself. He was saved. Then they went back to England, and they arrived in July, and by the following December, she was dead. So I wondered, does this mean in some way that on a personal level her life was a failure, that it ended in tragedy? What was it? What was going on here? The biographers told us very little about the marriage because very little was known. Mm-hmm. Even the later biographies didn't have access to a lot of material. So I think I was focused on, how can I define her life by the end of it?
Right. And actually, yes, it does. And in so many ways, it's the perfect time for her to be reflecting on a life that will fill out this novel because, here she is toward the end of her life and she can look back. But it's also just a really interesting chapter in what she chose to do, and the choices that she made, particularly through the lens of all of her life's work and thoughts about being a woman and marriage, and we can talk more about that,
yes.
But just so interesting.
That was what I was trying to do. As I began to explore this late life marriage, initially I was thinking of concentrating mostly on those events in Venice, the courtship
right.
prior to that, the events after, but then I realized in order to understand the marriage, I had to go back into her life and to look at the way she saw herself as a woman and also the way she saw men and their importance in her life.
Right. And that I'm so glad that that's what you did. It was just really fascinating to see her young self, how she defined herself and what she wanted in her life as a younger woman and how that, grew and changed. Now, you mentioned a minute ago the material that there was to work with. I'm sure there's a great deal of biographical material. Is that true? How did you find the research portion of this project?
Well, first of all, it cannot be underestimated how the internet has changed research for everyone, scholars, authors, because many, many documents are now digitalized on the internet, especially documents from major libraries. Therefore, you can find them easily, and they're accessible in a way they never were. You don't have to travel to Princeton to look and see if the notes from her final novel are in the Princeton Library. You come across them if you look hard. They've been digitalized by Princeton, and therefore I could use them. The other things that I was very interested in trying to find out more about Johnny Cross, too.
Yes.
And I did manage to find a few things about him that weren't known. And again, some of it was just learning how to look for it on the internet. Again, it was digitalized. There were out-of-print books now. Many of them are available on Google Books.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went, of course, I went to England, I went to Venice to do my research. But is that the answer to your question?
Yeah, yeah. And so there was a great deal to work with, but you had to find it sounds like.
Yes, you had to know how to find it.
Yeah.
And you had to be patient, but it was extremely interesting, and I loved the research part of it, looking at the floor plans of her houses, finding contemporary remarks about her and her doings.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, actually, that was the fun part of the novel. And all novels are difficult to write, but it was particularly fun doing that, charting her train journeys by looking at old railway timetables.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, these are little tiny moments in the book that I wondered if they were real. And, all the little details do add up to this beautifully filled out story, which I'm sure some of which you created and invented and some of which you found in journals and letters. So, for example, the Linnet story that she liked her father to read to her. Was that true? Or is that something that that's true?
Yes. There's nothing, as you point out, some of the stuff that I put in the novel, some of the things were invented, but I put nothing in the novel, and this is important, that I knew for a fact could not or did not happen.
Okay.
I don't know if Now, the limit, she had written, or told, rather, John Cross, her husband, who, as you may know, published the first biography of her after she died. She had told him that her father had given her her first book, The Linnet's Life. Now, I was able to find that, a photocopy of that, in Google Books, and it showed the plates that she must have stared at as a child. It showed the lines of the poetry. And I began to think, if you look at the text of the poem, it's about a homely little bird who has a beautiful voice and an inner sweetness, which is, in a sense, the way she saw herself.
Mm-hmm.
And wanted to be. If she was homely, she wanted to at least have an inner sweetness. And that's probably what she was thinking about as a little girl.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I loved how she identified with the little girl in The Linnet's Life. And you have a sentence, the little girl in The Linnet's Life was her.
Yes.
Lovely. Now, this is another little dumb detail,
sure,
but I just was fascinated by it, the description of Spencer's earplugs, which he basically used to tune people out.
Don't you love Herbert Spencer? First of all, that came from the biography of Herbert Spencer, one of the biographies, and from people who saw him. He was extremely eccentric.
Yeah.
My guess would be, to put it mildly, that he probably was what we today would call on the Asperger's scale.
Uh-huh.
You know, he was very, very strange. He had a number of habits, and in his autobiography, which he worked on for years and years and years, if you recall, there's a question where he talks about, there's a point in the novel where he discusses with Eliot his autobiography and describes these salt cellars and how he's annoyed by modern salt cellars because they're circular and not oval. And it's true. It comes from his autobiography.
Yeah.
And I found him very amusing. Sometimes I think he even knew he was funny.
Yeah, yeah. One thing I found a little bit sad about that part of her life, not so much after she got to know him better, but early on, she's so desperate for someone to love her, and despite his very odd behavior and eccentricity, she's thinking right from the start, well, maybe this is someone who can love me. Maybe someone like this can love me. And in fact, as their friendship deepens, it becomes more of a possibility that didn't make me sad, but just that she was so desperate and so self-critical. And
I agree with you. That's a very sad part of her. And it's a big part of her.
It is.
The need to be loved and to love. She had a great overflowing inner love, which she wanted to give away. Here she was, one, very homely by contemporary standards. She had, you know, been her father's favorite, but rejected by her father at first when she had a religious crisis. Her brother rejected her when later, this all happened after Spencer, but she, you know, she was already past marriageable age when she knew Spencer.
Mm-hmm.
She probably thought she would never marry, and he was brilliant, very strange. He was attentive, but I think fundamentally asexual. And the letter that is quoted in the novel is really a letter that she wrote to him after he seemed to break up with her. One of the few letters that John Cross did not destroy. I don't know if he knew about its existence, but it shows the absolutely terrible, shattered state she was in when he couldn't love her,
mm-hmm,
or wouldn't love her because she was plain.
Right.
And it's very sad. That's one of the saddest letters I've ever seen from a woman to a man who's broken up with her.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking a little bit about her looks, and I ran across this quote or this this thing that Henry James had said, I'm sure you've run across it. She had a low forehead, a dull gray eye, a vast pendulous nose, a huge mouth full of uneven teeth, and a chin and jawbone, and then he said in French, that never end. Now in this vast ugliness resides a most powerful beauty, which in a very few minutes steals forth and charms the mind, so that you end, as I ended, in falling in love with her. Yes, behold me in love with this great horse-faced blue stocking.
Oh, yes.
I mean, just
God, yes, it's so sad. It's very, you know, my view is that James himself was not perhaps sexually drawn to women. And he would find those qualities in her that were not attractive. But the fact is, she, as she grew older, she became, from the very few pictures that exist, what we would call ugly, almost. Her teeth were bad. But when she was a young woman in her 20s, there's, I have a picture hanging on my wall in the living room that I got from the National Portrait Gallery in London of her as at about the age of 21, and she looks, it was painted by her girlfriend. It has a kind of naive quality, and she looks very sweet, very pretty. And she typically would say, oh, Kara, that was the girl's name, you idealized me. That's not me. But
is that Kara Bray?
Sure how long, yes, Kara Bray, her best, or her friend at that time. So she was, but she was homely. And it's very hard in that era where women were judged very much by the way they looked, as they are now, but much more so. The options are much fewer. So,
In the way that you depicted people's reactions to her, I had this sense that people were fascinated and repulsed both by her looks and her intellect. They were drawn to it and surprised and shocked by it, as well as to her looks. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about how people's reactions impacted her life and her work.
Okay. Now, first, she, I think, began to realize that her intelligence and her intellect were, if you want to call it a weapon, that would be perhaps possible. Certainly they were an asset, a draw. She knew that she probably began to realize that men were fascinated by it because she was a woman and she had such a powerful intellect that. This was before she became a novelist. She was editor of the Westminster Review, which was then the preeminent literary journal in London. And she was also a very, very good journalist, by the way. And so she knew, I think she was aware that people would be drawn to her. You know, she cultivated her voice and made it very soft. And she, I think, was aware that people would lean in, pardon my using that phrase, to listen to her, you know. As for her look, she was very sure that she wasn't pretty. And others, they did discuss it. But it was as if, for some, for many people, the intellect was such a magnetic force that it pulled them in despite whatever doubts they had about her looks. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the irony. There are so many ironies in her life. The irony of writing as a man in order to have her work taken seriously. The irony of what she wants and needs in wanting love. And at one point she wants marriage and children too. Of having to marry a young man late in life in order to be cared for, despite the fact that she is a well-known and highly respected writer and editor, as you said. I mean, just all of this must have been so incredibly frustrating for her.
Which part of it?
The woman's lot in life at that time, and her sort of walking the line between overcoming that lot in life because she's educated and she's able to make a living and she's well respected as a writer, and yet still having to rely on men, either the name of a man, which she takes in her work, but also, you know, she marries Johnny. You know, maybe there was love there, but also there's definitely the sense that that was to help her. He was going to help her with her finances, and so I guess all of it sort of is.
It is an irony, and you know, there's a strange line between independence, our contemporary notions of independence, that why should we rely on a man for basic needs such as managing finances, managing our business affairs, managing our travel, and the utter loneliness that she felt when George had died. But I do feel that she was a woman very, very dependent on men. And actually, this reading of her was disputed by one person in the pre-publication reviews. I think the implication was that I had put too much emphasis on this, and the person, the critic, wanted me to portray her as more independent. But actually, I don't think that's true. I think she was terribly vulnerable. You remember her mother died when she was 16, but prior to that, her mother had been really ill. And she did not... the belief is that she really never even had a mother's full love, though I think her father favored her in his own way. So it's a fact. She is a woman. She was desperately lonely. Her life was emptied out after George died. And she did, in some way, respond to that need with Johnny.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about the book's structure. As we said, you sort of ground the book in this period of time toward the end of her life, when she and Johnny have gotten married, and they are... they are together in Venice. And then you kind of go back and forth in time, giving us earlier parts of her life in chapters. And so I wondered how you found that structure and if it was pretty easy for you to move through that time the way you had set it up.
I'll tell you something. It was very difficult.
Was it?
Yes. First of all, I wrote a version of the novel that was very much grounded in the present. That means Venice, the courtship with Johnny, marriage, the aftermath. But I felt that I could not understand this marriage and this ending without going back. So then how to do it? And I struggled with that very issue in a literary sense with the structure of the novel. Dante helped me.
Johnny
Cross, as Johnny Cross said, we fell in love through Dante. Well, I began to... I used the Dante, the various lines from the Divine Comedy as chapter headings to help me separate out these sections. I worked very hard to try to make you want to go on. You know, you were in the childhood during the reform movement of 1832. You were watching her religious crisis. You had to move all the way through her early years in London. It was all I can tell you, it was very difficult. And that was the second draft of the novel.
Okay. Well, I didn't at all get the sense of you trying to help us want to move forward. I just wanted to move forward. So
that's a great compliment to me, and it means a great deal. That was where the work really was.
I wanted to talk a little bit about her opinions of other writers. And also, I was just blown away by the writers who were in her circle. And at one point, she's living with Charles, what's his last name?
Well, you mean Charles Bray of Coventry?
No, right. Not Charles. She's
John
living
Chapman?
Yes, that's
in
right.
The Strand? Yes, owned... Yes.
In the Strand. Sorry. No. Yes, I mixed up my first names there. So she's living with him, and all of these people are at one party. Emerson is there. Karl Marx is there. Charles Dickens is there. Really?
That's very, very smart. God, thank you for asking. Okay. So, indeed, those people, we know that all those people attended those parties, those soirees, on Friday. Every Friday he had them. And he was an important publisher of, especially of radical types. Marx was in London then. Dickens, he was acquainted with Dickens. They were involved in a movement to get publishers, basically to improve their royalties on their books.
Okay.
They were joined together. So, yes, this was the center of London, and every Friday, Mazzini, there were other people
right.
who came. they were all, it was quite marvelous. She was then just this secret editor. She would play the piano. We don't have any record that she ever spoke to Marx because the room was often crowded. She was acquainted with Dickens, we know mm-hmm. that, but not mm-hmm. a friend. Darwin, she knew
yes,
Darwin later.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Yeah, you mm-hmm. mentioned Darwin in the book. And then you've already mentioned this, but I was curious about her opinions of these writers. You mentioned that she felt like Dickens maybe was a little too surface and didn't go interior into
yes,
the interior
yes.
of his characters enough. Were these thoughts recorded in journals or letters,
yes,
or did you?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. That was that particular insight. I can't remember. It came from either. It definitely was real. She did feel that way about him. She remarked that he was undistinguished looking, considering his great fame. He was only about 6 years older than she was, but she had not yet achieved her fame, and he was very famous. I think that came either from a letter writing back to Coventry to friends saying what it was like being in London, or it could have been in a diary, but yes, that's exactly true.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Wonderful. I'm going to skip into a little bit different mode right now. I wanted to ask you,
okay.
as far as writing the Venetian scenes, I wondered
yes.
if you have advice for writers about conveying language and culture in a foreign setting. You have certain sentences, not a lot throughout the book, but a little bit
yes.
in the beginning to kind of set the scene. You have sentences that are all in Italian, I'm
yes.
presuming.
Yes.
What's your how did you feel when you were doing that? Were you concerned that you were maybe going to lose anybody, or did you feel like because you were explaining it a little bit subtly, but explaining it in the following passage, that it was fine?
Well, my advice would be, don't overdo it. If you need to convey, as I was trying to, that they were multilingual. I think I used this Italian to indicate what a tourist was like in 19th century Venice, to indicate that they were both foreign and trying to be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to be very careful. I didn't want to stop the reader. I wanted to convey that they were in a foreign country and trying to be a little bit Italian, but they were distant.
Yes.
So if I hope it didn't stop you, because
not
that was
all.
Another issue, I would say be careful. I don't like it when you want to throw the book across the room and think, well, why is she doing this or he doing this author? I'm an English-speaking person. So I saw it a little bit as almost a music in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to show her fluency in Italian. His efforts to speak Italian, because later you learn he's really not very smart, or he's certainly not fluent in Italian. So, but you have to be careful, I think,
right.
very careful. Yeah.
And just so that the listener understands what we're talking about, there's this, for example, one scene where she's speaking with a chambermaid who clearly doesn't speak English, and at one point the chambermaid, as she took the glass, the maid glanced at her hands, and then there's a line of Italian, which I won't try to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then the response is, "Thank you, that's very sweet." She spread out her fingers. People always noticed her hands. Her fingers were long and slender, good for the piano, the skin delicate, nearly transparent. So we know that the maid has just complimented her on her hands,
yes.
and I thought that was very well done.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I think that was probably what was on my mind, trying to make you understand that was the maid, you know, talking to her.
Right, and it also just gives us a little sense of, oh, she can be proud of her hands. She doesn't have a face that's pretty, but her hands are pretty, right? And that was
yes.
kind of nice, too. Another aspect of the Italian story was the gondolier.
Yes.
And I was interested in your depiction of the gondolier and his role in this book. He doesn't have a personal story so much, but he's definitely a very important presence. Can you just talk to your decision to give him that presence in the book?
Well, that was a very interesting decision. First of all, the name Corradini appears in accounts of their being in Venice as their gondolier. That's
okay,
all
that was
we
his
know.
Name, yes.
Yes. Then, this is the part of the novel that, the Venice part is the part where I had to do the most creative work because so little is known. I used the gondolier because I wanted to try to understand Johnny's sexuality, mm-hmm. if I could. Mm-hmm. And evidently something went on in Venice that upset him very much. We don't know what it was, except he tried to kill himself.
Yeah.
And Venice was a gay mecca. Mm-hmm. There were many, many gay people, and the gondoliers sometimes earned money having sex with tourists. Mm-hmm. There was a very famous, a then famous writer, Simons, who lived in Venice with his gondolier lover and his gondolier's wife and children in his palazzo, a rich Englishman. So I created Corradini as a way to try to deal with whatever was going on with Johnny sexually, to suggest he might have had some kind of homosexual life. And this was one way of doing it, partly because that was the kind of thing that did happen with tourists.
Right, right, okay.
Yes.
Wonderful, great, thank mm-hmm. you. Now, another scene that I was really taken with in that same setting and time period is the scene where George, okay, so not George Eliot, but George is it Lewis or Lewes?
Lewis.
So, mm-hmm. so George Lewis, who's deceased at this point, he appears to her in her bedroom, and mm-hmm. She's so sad. She misses him so much, and he appears as a very sad ghost, no longer her laughing man, she says. That's
yes.
a really
yes.
interesting scene to me. And I just wondered if you could talk about your decision to include that. Was that in her journals,
well,
too?
No, not at all. See, that was made up by
okay.
me.
Okay.
It was because, I'll tell you, I've heard a couple of instances in my own family. When my father died, my stepmother said that she woke up at night and she saw him in the room. And then I heard of another instance where a widow again woke up at night and saw her husband in the room. And I was so moved by that, so utterly, profoundly shaken by those scenes. And I gave it to Eliot because I felt she loved this man so much, mm-hmm. and he could appear. I don't know quite, it's obviously a sort of a hallucination. A person is waking from a dream, is used to seeing her spouse there, and she, for a moment, thinks she has seen the spouse. So I used it. I borrowed it.
Well, it was a nice encapsulation of also, you know, George and how he was a character, you know, and so as he's standing there, he's no longer this funny, eccentric character. He's very serious in the room. So
yes.
that gave us some insight, too, into all that she's missing and all that she's feeling. So,
And she's, may I add that he has crossed to the other side. He's crossed the river. He's been ferried by the boatman Sharon mm-hmm. across the river. He's in a dark place, mm-hmm. and he's now knows the meaning of existence, and she's going to go to that dark place. In Death in Venice, Thomas Mann imagines himself on the boat going across the river mm-hmm. in death, and I borrowed a little of that too. Mm-hmm. There is a scene where she is on the boat being rowed by the gondolier and thinks of that too. So mm-hmm. he's seen it. You know, life is not fun.
and death is on her mind.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, his death and her own death. She had a very bad health. She had kidney problems for years and years.
Yeah.
And she'd had attacks.
Now, I found it interesting that George Lewis also used a pseudonym when he wrote. He used the pseudonym Vivian, although at first I was like, oh, wow. But it wasn't a woman's persona. It was a man. It was a ladies' man. So was this very in vogue, this use of pseudonyms at that time?
Yes. Yes. And especially for critics, because a lot of journalism was anonymous anyway. But Vivian, it's a male name, by the way. In England, at that time, there were men called Vivian.
Okay.
And he was simply a device. He was a very good theater critic. He was very, very funny. I read his theater criticism. He's a person I would have liked a lot, I think. And, I think I would have liked him very much. He was brilliant. He was funny. He was broke. He was generous. He was kind. He was just a good guy.
Yeah.
He's one of my favorite people, actually. And then, you know, his biography of Goethe was one of the most important biographies of Goethe for at least a century, and still is important. So he was really an amazing man, and he loved
That's
her.
Great. Yeah, and I loved that she didn't let people talk her out of him. You know, a lot of people tried to talk her out of seeing him and warn her away from what would happen if she stayed with him. And I think I just really enjoyed that part of the book, that she was just able to look at them and say, you know what, you don't know me. You don't know. You're not me. And
right.
I'm making
and he
this
had
choice.
Been a ladies' man. He was a terrible flirt. He was a rake. I mean, even though he was apparently very unattractive. I don't think he looks that unattractive in the pictures, but I think Carlyle called him the ape.
Well, there's a lot in your book. There's a lot about how hairy he is. Apparently, he was quite hairy.
Yes, his eyebrows met in the middle, you know, and he was,
Well, Denisha, I wanted to ask you, what are you working on now? I know you're doing this big book tour, so probably you're not able to work on much these days. But have you got a new project that you're thinking about?
Yes, I am thinking about a new project. I'm working on it. I don't know yet if it's going to happen. It's a very different novel. It's about Israel, actually.
Oh. Okay.
Set in 1986 at the time of the first Intifada. But I'm not sure yet if it's going to be a novel.
Now, it's interesting. You must really love the research aspect of your novels, I'm guessing. You go for such interesting subjects with rich material to study. Is that true?
I did enjoy this research. I mean, enjoy is a funny word to use when you're writing a novel. It's so difficult. But the first three novels did not involve very much research. That's not true. The first novel was set in Detroit during the time when young radicals from the East were going to work on the assembly line. So that was very difficult. That one involved a lot of research. I should say that I have done it. I do enjoy going to worlds that are not my own.
Mm-hmm.
I love creating characters, imagining them, people who are not, or I don't think are me. I have written one novel that is somewhat autobiographical, my second novel, but actually it's my least favorite novel, so there you are.
Now, which one was The Illusionist? Was that your third?
That was my third novel, and
it
was inspired by a true story of the character in what became the movie Boys Don't Cry, Tina Brandon, this woman who lived the life of a young man in a small town and dated lots of teenage girls, and then when it was discovered that he was a girl, there was a catastrophe. So I used that premise, what was it like to live disguised that way, as the basis of a novel. I made the story into something else, and that was The Illusionist.
Okay, great. I was going to ask if you've read any books lately that you've particularly enjoyed that you might recommend to listeners.
Oh, God. I've been reading... I'm afraid that my reading is rather broad. I'm looking at a book by a woman called Sarah Blakewell about the French intellectuals in the 30s and 40s in Paris.
Oh.
And it happens to be published by my publisher. I'm just getting the title. It's called At the Existentialist Cafe.
Oh, I have that book. I have not read that yet. How is that book?
Well, it is, first of all, I'm again, remember that she is published by my publisher. That's why I haven't read. I think it's incredible. First of all, it's beautifully written, but the learning is astonishing. And the learning is presented in as clear and as conversational way as possible. So I've enjoyed that very, very much. Although I have to confess that I'm still not entirely clear about what Heidegger was saying, and she writes about Heidegger, Sartre, de Beauvoir. I've been looking at rereading The Age of Innocence because I'm going to be giving a talk about it at the New York Public Library.
Oh, yes,
and then I've been rereading John le Carré. I just came back from vacation, and I'm full of admiration for him, as usual. So the reading is very, very, very broad.
Very broad.
I've also been reading books about Jerusalem. There's a new book called Till We Have Built Jerusalem by Adina Hoffman about the building of that city, which I'm reading from my own work. A memoir by Edward Said about being a Palestinian in Egypt and then America and in Jerusalem. That all is for the possible book I might write. And so that gives you... There's not much coherence there, but anyway.
No, it's great. I actually have just one last question for you. I usually like to finish these interviews with a question asking for a little bit of advice for writers. And I thought I would ask you about writing John Walter Cross's character. But advice-wise, I was wondering if you can offer advice for writing about characters that are in emotional distress or possibly have mental illness. I felt like you managed that really well with him.
Okay. One of the things I did with John Walter Cross was... I'm very interested in discussing this, actually. Okay, all we know from her diaries, by the time he tried to commit suicide, she had reduced her diary writing to just the minimum. She gives the name of two doctors who attended him, but nothing more. I looked those doctors up. I found out they were both the equivalent of contemporary psychiatrists. So I began reading about what kinds of mental illness were constructed in that period in the 19th century. When I say constructed, a set of symptoms was given a name, right? And I read contemporary accounts of what we would call manic depression or bipolar illness. That helped me understand the way he might have behaved, the obsessive way. He becomes obsessed with Ruskin, with seeing everything. That I had to totally make up. I had to figure out how would this guy behave. We only know that he wasn't eating and sleeping much. We knew from her diaries, but she thought it was excitement about the wedding. But in the case of, I tried to see this illness through 19th century eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I gave him behavior that corresponded with what I read in these accounts. There'll be an account by the equivalent of a psychiatrist saying there tends to be repetitive behavior. Often there's a period of amnesia following a manic attack or whatever phrasing they used. So that's how I did that guy. As for contemporary mental illness, I presume I just have to look up descriptions from a contemporary point of view of that kind of behavior.
Yeah, okay. Wonderful. Once again, I just want to say that my guest today has been Denisha Smith. Her book is The Honeymoon, published by The Other Press. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
And thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Denisha Smith. You can learn more about her work at her publisher's website, otherpress.com. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu, and by Main Street Landing, providing daily rental space For events, meetings, conferences, and parties, visit MainStreetLanding.com for more information or come on down to the Burlington waterfront. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at Big Heavy World every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast by going to my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. You can also visit the website of my co-host, Gary Miller, GaryLeeMiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Write the Book was chosen by Writer's Digest in the present issue that's out now as one of 101 best websites for writers. So that magazine is out right now, and we appreciate your support. We hope that you enjoy the podcast. So please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. And this has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro. You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.